This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We're ready to discuss the important events of this past week. We have our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
We have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Headlines have been dominating recent months on how Europeans are being pushed and provoked by Muslims. Muslims who are flooding into Europe through immigration, radical Muslims who have carried out terrorist attacks against European targets. We at the Trumpet expect Europe to respond, and at some point very forcefully, against these provocations. And you can see the European public growing more agitated, supporting more nationalist parties, anti-immigration parties, lashing out against Muslims personally, protesting against European leaders who are weak on this issue. But a development that gets far less press, we're also seeing European nations taking steps to address this issue militarily, beefing up their military capability, and even sending troops into areas throughout northern Africa and the Middle East, where they're in a stronger position to act against radical forces there. Our top story today regards one of these deployments. And for this, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
There's a good reason why a lot of this doesn't get a lot of press, and that's European nations don't really make a big deal about it. A lot, especially France, they don't necessarily make a big song and dance of everything that they do. And we're so ahead of their intervention in Mali. They clandestinely got militarily involved in Niger. They were militarily involved in Libya for months and months, or strong evidence they were, for months and months and months, until a French helicopter got shot down and some French personnel were killed and they had to admit to it. And so now we're seeing some early signs that they might be doing the same thing in Yemen, and that French forces, or at least French weaponry, may already now being used in the conflict in Yemen, even though they've not really publicly admitted that yet.
Maybe you could just give us a digest of the situation in Yemen and why France would be interested in getting involved.
Well, ultimately, in Yemen, you've got a clash between, in general, a Sunni alliance led by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels who are rebelling against the United Nations sanctioned government there. Now, in a lot of ways, this doesn't directly impact France. I think if you were to look at the most direct impact, as I understand it, and Brent may correct me if I'm wrong, Al-Qaeda and any elements that may attack France, like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, are against the Houthis. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. Well, they are for now. Yep.
I mean, that's why I wanted to check. It does get a little bit complicated, and the situation is pretty fluid. And Brent watches that a little more closely than I do. But France is getting involved largely to oppose the Houthis, who don't really have anything to do with France. So it's an interesting example now of France very strongly backing this Sunni alliance for wider geopolitical reasons than maybe specifically what's happening on the ground. Now, the evidence for their involvement, the most immediate and the reason why, or the anchor point for this article that's written on it, is that there's some satellite imagery that shows two hangars in Assab in Eritrea that match other French hangars in the region. And so that's a physical indication that we have of French troops and maybe French planes down there. But then when you look back since about April 2015, there's been very strong French support for Saudis, and they've voiced a lot of support for that region. So that's when they began in April 2015 voicing political support for the Saudi coalition. France launched a strategic partnership with the Gulf Cooperation Council. France was and always will be your friend, he said. In 2016, they gave the Légion d'honneur to, that's France's highest honor, to the Saudi crown prince. So that's an indication of strong ties there, and that France is determined to build strong ties there. And then they talked about joint cooperation for combating extremism and terrorism. And so, you know, that's deliberately vague, but it indicates that they may well be having military operations together.
This is definitely something that would raise a lot of eyebrows among longtime Trumpet readers and listeners to Trumpet Radio because of the alliance that we expect to see and that we've been tracking the development of between Europe and these Sunni, Arab, and Middle Eastern nations.
Right, exactly. And we've been saying for years, based on a scripture in Psalm 83 that describes a host of Muslim powers that today mostly correspond to the so-called moderate Sunni Arab states, being allied with this coming European power. And now we see France and I'm sure other European nations now with it very closely in this alliance with these exact nations. It's not an exact match so far with Psalm 83. There are some changes we're expecting. Egypt, for example, is part of this Sunni-led alliance right now. They are not mentioned in Psalm 83, and we expect them to switch to be aligned with Iran. But taking a general overview, you see exactly that alliance right now.
And so much of this, what we see happening in Yemen is, in particular, is a result of, it's a reaction against Iran's aggression in the region and just how much it has grown in power over this last year. So you really have an interesting alignment of trends here. America has been doing a lot that has been helping Iran's rise since the nuclear deal was made earlier. We'll talk about that later in the program. But France and other European nations are having to respond to that. Saudi Arabia certainly reacting against that and coming together in these alliances, this coalition, in an effort to check Iran.
Right. And it also shows, I think, a certain amount of strategic thinking from France. And you look at the areas that they are getting involved. Mr. Gerald, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, he's drawn attention to the way Iran is trying to get control of Europe's sea gates and that the efforts they've made to gain control of Yemen, the efforts they're making to get control of Egypt, and then there's the Suez Canal there. The efforts they're making in spreading terrorism throughout North Africa and into Libya, because these are areas that will have a real impact on trade. And you're seeing France start to get involved in the same areas, showing that they're obviously concerned about what Iran is doing, about these sea gates. And so they're getting involved. I don't think it's not just building this alliance with Saudi Arabia is a big part of it, but it's not just that. I'm sure it's having a base in Eritrea, the strategic position that Iran is gaining in Yemen. That's got their attention, so they're looking at getting involved there. They're, of course, heavily involved in Mali. Europe is getting more involved in Libya. So they're thinking about these sea gates as well, and they're getting ready to respond to Iran in those key sea gates.
Excellent analysis. While we're on this subject of European incursions into that region, we're going to pick up a related story from Brent.
Yeah, French soldiers, French commandos have been, as Richard said, have been moving and working inside Libya for the past couple of months. And the main reason that they're there, at least the reason that they've stated, is to get rid of the Islamic State from the coastal city of Sirte, in the very center of Libya. And this past week, it looks like they have successfully pushed out the Islamic State along with some local militias down there from that city. The Islamic State's not going anywhere in Libya. It can go down to further south. And Libya's a huge nation, and it probably realized its time was up there in Sirte, and they're going to spread out towards the south. But the French are there, and the other European nations, the Italians, the Germans, have all talked about the need to stabilize Libya to ensure that the migrant flows stop. migrants come from Africa or different parts of Africa, and they come through Libya before they set sail up into Italy. So to counteract those migrant flows, they tried to destroy the Islamic State to try and create some stability, and they've tried to create a government from the rivaling factions within Libya to ensure that they have a partner to work with, a partner in which they can give arms to, a partner in which they can train militarily to then govern the country to stop themselves, to be able to stop these migrants from coming through into Europe. So the government that they've set up, the UN-backed government that has been set up in Libya, the government of national accord, it doesn't have, at this point, too much legitimacy. There was even a vote this week, the first vote that the House of Representatives has had inside Libya. And this is a totally separate government in the east. And they denounced the government of national accord, basically who the Europeans are working with to try and stop the migrant flows. They said it doesn't have any legitimacy and we're not going to support it. And yet this government, that this group of leaders basically that Europe is working with, they decided this week that they were going to start training their navy. And this was an agreement that was signed in Rome on Tuesday by Italian Rear Admiral Enrico Credendino. And he heads this operation, Operation Sophia, which is the European operation in the southern Mediterranean to stop these migrants from coming in. And he said they're starting this next phase of it, which is to directly train the navy of Libya, the navy of the government of national accord, which will possibly start off with Libyan soldiers coming aboard European vessels, learning how they do things, and then European soldiers ending up training the navy on Libyan soil.
It's a tremendous amount of involvement there in that region. It just seems like it continues to pose a real thorn in Europe's side. But the fact that European soldiers are so deeply involved there is definitely something that we can expect to increase at some point, whether or not it's in Libya directly. I'd like to transition to really maybe the elephant in the room, and that is just how much Iran's presence in the region is kind of driving some of these events. Probably the biggest story of 2016 has been the implementation of the nuclear agreement with Iran. And it's a story that keeps getting bigger. Not only does Iran continue to grow in power and influence as a result of this deal, which is causing some of these ripple effects that we're seeing in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, but we also keep learning more unbelievable details about how the deal was made. To learn more about some of the latest revelations about Iran, we'll go back to Brent.
Yeah, it seems that all these details are coming up after the fact, and some of them are dated all the way back till 2009 to some of these hidden facts about the relationship that the Obama administration was building with the Iranian Islamist regime in order to build the scenario in which the nuke deal could be accomplished. Now, it wasn't signed I don't even know if it's been signed yet. Nobody really knows, but it's been implemented at least this year. But for the past 7 years, the United States has given Iran a free card to operate in the region, whether it's in Syria, to operate in Syria, to not go after Assad, even to operate in Yemen. It's been interesting just this week to go back to Richard's story. Just this week on Thursday, the United States said that they're going to try something new in Yemen, and they're going to try and include the Houthis, the Iranian-backed Houthis, in a unity government with the Saudi-backed leaders there. So they're going to try and create this unity government with an Iranian-backed terrorist group, which rings bells of Lebanon back in 2006 when Hezbollah joined the unity government there and basically then completely shut down the government system in Lebanon and basically made that state an Iranian proxy. And the United States is kind of pushing that, it seems, in Yemen, at least what it looks like this week. But to go to some of those revelations that came out this week, there was a book published this week by Jay Solomon. He's a Wall Street Journal reporter, and he wrote a book, The Iran Wars. And it looks like Eli Lake from Bloomberg View got an advanced copy because the day it was released, he already had an article about it. And the thing that he discusses in here was the revelation that back in 2009, there was, at the election of Ahmadinejad, there was a large, extremely large movement called the Green Movement that wanted to overthrow the Iranian Islamist system. And 500,000 people came out into the streets. They were trying to get rid of the what was an American enemy for the past, since 1979, for decades. And you would think that America would support that. That's what people thought. Is it possible that America is going to support that, to overthrow an enemy? But it came out this week that President Obama, even back then, was looking forward to working with the Iranian regime, and he could put the kibosh on anyone, including the CIA, to stop trying to encourage, finance, support in any way, even vocally, this green movement. He says, as Solomon writes here, he said that the CIA was planning to, as you would think they would, trying to not necessarily infiltrate that election process, but at least support it. Give the people on the ground some support from the superpower of the world. But they were told, as Solomon writes, the agency had its contingency plans for supporting democratic uprisings anywhere in the world. And this includes providing dissidents with communications, money, and in extreme cases, even arms. But in this case, the White House ordered it to stand down. Don't get involved in that election. Yes, we want Gaddafi out. Yes, we're going to want Mubarak out, an ally of the United States, and we'll speak vocally against him. But when it comes to Iran, no, we want the Iranian regime in there, because we're going to get this nuke deal passed in a couple of years' time.
In a sense, it's shocking. In another sense, it's so consistent with everything that we've seen out of this administration with respect to Iran. And really, you can see how those decisions early on really paved the way for what we've seen happen, what we've seen unfold over this past year. Really remarkable. Well, we're going to travel now to the other side of the world, to China. We've been tracking a number of moves by this Asian giant that demonstrate its global ambitions. Today, we're going to focus on some moves it's making in Australia. There's an Australian official this week made a decision drawing attention to what he says is China threatening his nation's security. And for this story, we'll go to Andrew.
Yeah, well, China's definitely pretty upset with Australia this week. They had negotiated a deal, or I guess the State Grid Corporation, which is a government Chinese government-owned electrical company, had negotiated a deal with the Australian electrical company, Ausgrid, to buy a 50.4% controlling share in their company on a 99-year lease. They're going to spend about $7.6 billion on this deal, which would have given basically the Chinese government a controlling share in the company that services all the electrical needs for most of New South Wales. And then, so as you'd mentioned, the Australian Federal Treasurer, Scott Morrison, had stepped in and said that the government's putting the kibosh on this deal because of national security concerns. And then Beijing had written a letter back just really expressing how upset they were with that decision, especially considering it wasn't unique. They've actually have this same Chinese government-controlled company has bought large shares in three or four other Australian electrical companies.
Right. Yeah, we were talking a few weeks ago about just its incursions into New Zealand and buying farmland and that kind of thing. And we've had stories on the Trumpet about showing this same trend happening in Australia. But for them to be so deeply involved in energy production in Australia, really, you can see, first of all, why this individual, why the federal treasurer, would have put a stop to it, but also just how inconsistent that is with the way that Australia has been behaving for quite some time.
Right, it is definitely a change, and maybe they're starting to see that with all these companies being bought up, where this is heading. Especially because I know the president or CEO, whichever it is, of this Chinese company has been very honest about his long-term plan. He said he's got a $50 trillion plan that he's trying to unveil over the next 35 years. To basically have his company service the electrical needs for the planet. Where he said, we've got people up in the North Pole. He said, I can build windmills on the North Pole because no one lives there. And I can put solar grids in the Sahara since no one lives there. And then buy up all the electrical companies around the world and tie them into one grid that's got like green energy servicing the entire planet and, of course, run by China.
They're always thinking big, aren't they?
Right. It's it's quite the, and they've bought up plenty in Italy and Brazil and the Philippines as well. So this is definitely the movement they're trying to head in.
Did the treasurer at in Australia, did he talk about specific reasons why he felt like this was going to be a threat to Australian security?
I think he mostly said use the term national security threat, just the fact that you would have the Chinese have a controlling stake in the company that's giving most of the electrical, because the U.S. government's actually already put out a number of warnings that the Chinese government's had, like, hackers come into our electrical grid, not legal deals, but implant software chips mm-hmm. that they could use in the event of any future conflict to shut down portions of the U.S. electrical grid. And just think how much easier would something be that to do in Australia if they had sold them the electrical company. You don't need hackers to do it. You own it.
Right. Well, you're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We thank for that story, Andrew. One more story before the break. Another story out of Asia, specifically North Korea. This is among the most repressive regimes in the world. The government carefully controls all information that the public receives and makes sure that it's positive propaganda about the regime, but there's evidence that there are cracks in the government's control of its image. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yes, this is a rare bit of good news from North Korea, and it is basically that many of the nation's adolescents are no longer brimming with the patriotic zeal that their leaders indoctrinate them with from the earliest ages. There's a piece published. It was published, I think, on August 26th in the Chosun, which is a South Korean newspaper, and it says that despite the propaganda, more and more North Korean teenagers are beginning to understand that their repressive country is less affluent than South Korea. It's less affluent than China and the Western world. And this is exciting news to me because the situation in North Korea, as you said, is just so grim. It's so bleak, and the disinformation and the lies just saturate the lives of the people there. But this is kind of a glimmer of light, I think, showing that the regime's grip on that total control of information is loosening. And it's in large part because North Koreans, and especially those living near the border with China or with South Korea, are able to secretly watch TV shows and listen to radio broadcasts from those nations. It's highly illegal for North Koreans to do that, and it's very risky, but apparently more and more of them are risking it. And what they see and hear in those broadcasts is basically that life for the average Chinese person or for the average South Korean person is much more abundant than life is for North Koreans. And it's the exact opposite of the message that their government just shoves down their throats throughout their entire lives. That message from North Korea is just, as you said, it's very positive, but it even goes beyond that. It is basically North Korea is paradise. It's better than any other country on earth. Outside of North Korea, there's nothing of any real value. Everyone else in the world is backward and savage and far poorer than you are. So it's really the exact opposite of the truth. But then when these North Koreans see something like a man on the street interview from a South Korean news show, and they say, wait a minute, here's an 18-year-old South Korean girl, and she has her own car. She has her own iPhone. She looks much healthier and happier than the average malnourished North Korean 18-year-old. And so they're forced to accept that they've been fed a lot of lies about North Korea and about its standing in the world. So this disillusionment that's happening, I think, is a very positive development, because it could eventually lead to an overthrow of the Kim regime if enough people are disillusioned and if enough people realize the truth. But at present, this disillusionment is still not very widespread. It's limited to the wealthier youth who are affluent enough to have TVs and who are bold enough to risk watching illegal foreign channels. But it's still a sign of hope, I think, and an important trend for us to keep an eye on.
Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about the new Dictators Club, the actions of one of those dictators in Syria, how several European leaders are responding to these dangerous developments by demanding a European army, and the rise of a bizarre new trend in marriage, people who are marrying themselves. We'll be back in a moment.
Listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Before the break, we were talking about one of the most repressive dictatorships in the world, in North Korea. There are actually dictatorships rising elsewhere that are increasingly defining our world today. An article this week in the Wall Street Journal talked about this, and to tell us about it, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the column is called The New Dictators Club. It's written by Brett Stevens, and basically he just makes the case really compellingly, I think, that the emerging partnerships between Russia, China, Iran, and Turkey should be a source of major concern for Western powers. And basically he says that in these budding partnerships that we now see being forged, there are some eerie echoes of the 1930s. When the Axis powers were forging their alliance. So Stevens first makes the point that the tripartite pact that Germany, Italy, and Japan signed in 1940 didn't just happen overnight. That official pact was the culmination of months and months of smaller pacts and non-aggression treaties that these powers had signed with each other, and just all kinds of support of various kinds that they had given to each other. So before that pact was officially forged, that tripartite fact that ended up killing some 70 million people, before it was officially forged, these powers laid the foundation for it with lower-level cooperation and camaraderie. So from there, Stevens says that in light of that history, it's worth noting our new era of cooperation between dictatorships and to think about where that could lead. You know, you've got Russia and China. They've been laying the groundwork for official alliance for well over a decade now and cooperating in just about every realm you could imagine. Just on Monday, those two announced the latest phase of this partnership, saying that their two navies will hold broad-scale joint naval drills in the South China Sea. And this follows very closely on the heels of a coordinated effort by the two navies back in June to encroach Japanese territorial waters. And of course, Moscow and Beijing, they have their fair share of disputes and points of contention, but so did Germany and Italy. So did Japan and Germany. But what we see now, as we saw in the lead up to World War II, is those points of contention being trumped and kind of overridden by a shared goal of hobbling and diminishing the United States. For China, it's in the South China Sea that at once U.S. influence eroded. For Russia, it's in the NATO alliance led by America that's just across Russia's western border there. And Russia's willingness to participate in this military drill in the South China Sea is a really good reminder, I think, of Moscow's overriding foreign policy goal, which is to diminish the United States. And from there, the column also calls attention to the cooperation we see between Russia and Iran, which is actually the cover story of the Trumpet Weekly this week, and also the sudden thaw in Russia's relationship with Turkey. So Iran has allowed Russia to use its air bases to conduct some bombing raids on Syria, and now Turkey has said that it will do the same thing with its air bases. And these powers are not natural allies by any stretch, but the point that Brett Stevens makes is that neither were Germany and Japan. And I'll just finish with a quote from his column, which I would really encourage listeners to read the whole thing, but here's an excerpt. It says, "Perhaps it's in every strongman's nature to seek and admire his political reflection wherever he finds it, whether it's in a czar, an ayatollah, a sultan, or a general secretary. Then again, what mainly unites the leaders of the new dictators club is the shared perception that they stand to lose very little in working against a country they detest and a president they contemn. That's a perception that's unlikely to change with the next U.S. administration."
It really remarkable, just thinking about how much more they're able to accomplish, even looking at history, the history that you were talking about with World War II, in partnership, in tandem, than any of them is by themselves. But it just reminds me so much of the prophecy that we draw attention to quite often about just the rise of the Gentiles, the times of the Gentiles, and just what a radical departure this is from this British and American era, this Anglo-American Pax Americana that we have experienced for quite a long time, Pax Britannica, just how dangerous this world is becoming as the power shifts from that era to the next era. And the more power that these dictators claim, the more dangerous the world becomes. Very interesting to consider. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Jeremiah. One of these dictators, Recep Erdogan of Turkey, has been busy this past week regarding one of our favorite subjects on this program, one of the biggest hotspots on Earth today, Syria. To tell us about this, we will hear from Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it's a pretty big move this week by Turkey for the first time. Well, they've led troops into Syria before, but this week Turkey led its biggest ground operation into Syrian territory in the 5 years that the civil war has been going on in Syria. They massed troops on the border. They had a lot of Free Syrian Army, the rebels basically in Syria that were massed on the Turkish side of the border. And they had Turkish artillery fire in. American planes actually joined them in this. And then also about 20 tanks, Turkish tanks, came over the border into Syria, which is pretty scary when you think of the nations that are already involved and the groups that are already involved in Syria. Iran's heavily there. Russia's there. The United States is there. The Kurds are fighting. Islamic State's there. And now you've got one of the largest militaries in the Middle East, Turkey, putting its own troops and being into the Syrian fray and being very open about it as well.
What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, they say that they're trying to get rid of the Islamic State, and they are getting rid of the Islamic State. But why they're getting rid of the Islamic State is the good question. The reason is because in the very north of Syria, you have a region that is heavily populated by Kurds. And there was directly south of Turkey, there was a couple of cities where you had the Islamic State that pretty much separated two groups of Kurdish fighters. And Turkey is worried that if these Kurds can unify a large front on the Turkish border, that could then mobilize or encourage the Kurds that are inside Turkey to rise up against the government of Turkey. So you had what was scary for Turkey was the YPG, or the Kurds in Syria, their armed forces. They were marching along the border inside Syria of Turkey, and they were about to defeat the Islamic State in this city. And Turkey said, well, if they defeat that city, they're going to have this big contiguous landmass that they can control. We're not going to let that happen. We need to send our troops in there right now to basically split these two Kurdish forces.
Well, that's interesting. What's the, just comparing Turkey's interests in Syria with Russia's, how much do these butt up against one another, and how much does this put Turkey and Russia at odds with one another?
That's a very good question. I'd love to be involved in all the conversations that were happening the past 2 weeks between the Russians and the Turks, because they have closed their relationship. Turkey said a couple of weeks ago, for the first time in 5 years, that they could see a transitional period where Assad could rule for a while, like kind of a softening of their position, because Turkey has not wanted Assad in power. Russia does. So I don't necessarily think that Russia is really extremely happy that they're involved. Definitely the Iranians are not happy that Turkey is sending its troops in there. Turkey supports the main rebel faction that is fighting against the Syrian dictator, the rebels. And to have Turkish forces there supporting the rebels gives legitimacy to those rebels in a potential future government. So Iran is definitely not happy. But I think that Russia is allowing this. They haven't said too much against it. Whether they're happy about it or not, beside the point. They are allowing it. They're not, you know, raining down their airstrikes on these Turkish on the Turkish troops. So they're allowing it for the time being. Now, Turkey has long said that they wanted to create a buffer zone just south of the territory of their border in Syria so that they could stop all these migrants, all these asylum seekers flooding over the border going into Turkey. And this is what they're saying. They're going to be there for a long time, they've said. They're not coming in and out. They're going to fight other terrorists, not just the Islamic State, kind of like what Russia said as well when they went in there. And they're going to try and create a safe zone along their border so that they could stop people, Syrian refugees, coming into their country.
Such a complicated situation. I think too, about just what how this affects Europe and the Europe-Turkish relationship. It's just, there, like you said, there's so many competing entities there in Syria, and still the civil war continues. People continue to die. It seems like the conditions there just only get worse. But we will continue to keep our eye on it. We appreciate you bringing us up to speed on that development. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We were talking in the first half of the program about European military incursions into Yemen and Libya. We'll return to this subject. Calls from several European leaders who say that Europe must unify and beef up its military capability. And for this, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, so just in the last week, we've had the leader of the Czech Republic, or I guess Czechia, as they want to be known now, France, Germany, and Italian leaders all call for a European army, or emphasize the importance of a united European military. So the Czech Prime Minister, he said, "I'm convinced that we can't do without a European army in the long term." And he said, "I hope that the autumn European summit will bring concrete proposals and pledges." So European leaders, they're getting together in September for an informal post-Brexit meeting. And that's everybody except for Britain is invited to that meeting. And there has been a lot of speculation that, you know, Europe wants to have some big symbolic push for unity after Brexit. There's a lot of disagreement in a lot of other areas. But where it comes to military and security, there is much more agreement there. And so that could be exactly the kind of show-stopping announcement that Europe is looking for in the wake of Brexit. So we could see that coming in September, and it's certainly meant to be on the agenda for the October summit. So there are specific plans to be talking about this. So anyway, the Czech Prime Minister, he also said, "In the face of uncontrolled mass migration, even the states in the center of Europe have realized that internal borders must be controlled." And so he was talking as well about better coordinated foreign and security policy. So Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, she said, "We feel that faced with Islamic terrorism and the light of civil war in Syria, we need to do more for our internal and external security." And President Francois Hollande said, "Europe must ensure its own defense, and France is certainly playing a role." And they said all this while meeting on an aircraft carrier. Usually, you don't see European heads of state meeting in a military venue, but there was strong symbolism, and this was chosen for a reason. It was the Garibaldi, the Italian aircraft carrier, and I guess it is a little challenging to take seriously a warship that shares a name with a type of biscuit, but it was still designed to send a message. And then finally, the Italian chief of general staff, he also talked about how he said every step forward was blocked by the British. He said the British position was crucial. Everybody knew that without London, you couldn't even begin talking about a common European defense policy. And so now with Britain gone, that lowers a whole bunch of barriers that existed in the past to this kind of discussion.
So put this in context for us, Richard. We've obviously had a lot of talk about this very subject over the years, and especially after the British referendum leaving the European Union, it revived those talks. Is this an extension of what we've seen before? Are there any new developments apart from the fact that they were meeting on an aircraft carrier? Anything that shows that really this is moving forward?
No, not really. I mean, there was the fact that you had the Czechia leader, or the Czech Republic leader, who the Chechens, well, they often tend to be a more of a Eurosceptic. I mean, we have said right from the start that a lot of the traditionally Eurosceptic nations, like, say, the Czech Republic or Poland, are actually all for a European army, because one of the few things they do want the European Union to do for them is defend them against Russia. So the fact that you've got a leader from, say, one of these more reluctant European nations come forward and call for this shows that there is widespread support for it. But you know, you're right. Thus far, a lot of it has been just talk. There have been in the past some important steps towards this, but in terms of the developments from this week, it is just more talk.
Well, it definitely is interesting to put these comments and this discussion that's happening among European leaders in the context of the actions that they're taking, like we were talking about earlier, in Yemen, in Libya, and elsewhere. And certainly we can expect to see more of that in the future, for sure. We appreciate that. Richard, we're going to finish this segment with a truly bizarre story. Society has been working to expand the millennia-old definition of marriage, a union between one man and one woman, by legalizing same-sex marriage. But a new trend is on the rise, apparently, that of people who are marrying themselves. For this story, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, they had an article in The Spectator we have in our Trumpet Weekly this week. I remember I first heard of this like 2 years ago, where like some South Korean woman had thrown like a wedding for herself with the dress and cake and bridesmaids and all that, but just no groom. She was actually marrying herself. And I mean, at the time, I was just like, wow, I mean, people be crazy. But... And then here come 2 years later, that's actually, it is starting to pick up a bit. I guess according to this this article we have in the Trumpet Weekly, the first case they really know of someone who actually threw a wedding for themselves was in 1993. But since then, there's been several high-profile cases in America or Sweden or Britain of people who've actually... spent the money to have on a wedding ceremony, where they actually, a new trend that they've dubbed sologamy. So far, that's or like solo marriage, and it's probably a bigger thing in Japan than it actually is here. I think we've talked on this program before just how advanced some of the breakdown in the family in Japan has become, where they've actually got like travel agencies there that now offer like a package for like only $3,000, where you can book a wedding venue and a honeymoon suite and all sorts of, I think they used to offer even like a stand-in groom, which no one actually wanted that. They all wanted the pictures to be just of themselves. Mm-hmm. For their photo album. But as this article in The Spectator points out, I'm not exactly sure how many people have done this in Japan. In the United States, it's probably only a handful, but it is just really maybe more of an extreme manifestation of what is becoming the most common living arrangement in America, which is just being like single by choice or single for life. We've pointed out before that I think just about 2 years ago it finally passed, where there's more single adults than married adults for the first time in history, at least in the United States, at least. And at least about, as far as they can tell from whatever polls they've done, about 50% of those singles aren't even interested in a relationship. Now, granted, that's probably painting with a little wide brush in America's case. I mean, a lot of them could be focusing on a career, maybe in a graduate school, and they might just not be really interested in a relationship now. But still, they've they had a Time magazine article that recently where they're predicting, sociologists are predicting, that about 25% of the millennial generation will never marry in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. It's not just they're not going to marry in their 20s like they used to, or not postpone it to their 30s. The thing that's about 25% of the next generation. It's just something that wouldn't interest them.
Yeah, I'm glad that you're putting this in that context. There's obviously crazy people will do a lot of crazy things, but the fact that there is this more and more isolation among people, and just the breakdown within of those traditional family structures is really a very widespread trend. We've just finished the new edition of the Trumpet. This is the October edition of the Trumpet, actually. We just sent it off to the printer today. And the cover story is the government is meddling with family. It's actually Andrew Miller's story we talked about on the Trumpet Hour a couple of weeks ago about the nationalization of the family. Very fascinating story that I want to encourage every listener to read. It's a pretty lengthy article that just traces the history of what has caused a lot of the family breakdown in the country and just how much the government has increased its own power and benefited, in a sense, from the breakdown of the family and how the family and the government are in competition with one another. And you see this kind of self-oriented thinking that would be behind a trend like the one that you're describing here today. It really is something that the government has encouraged and that it has taken advantage of in the sense of increasing the amount of economic dependence by the populace on government handouts, on welfare, social programs, and that type of thing. It's a revolution in society.
Right. And I have seen quite a bit from both some of the more militant homosexual activists and from even what they call the singles right activist to just abolish the practice of giving marriage license, period. I think you might even have brought the homosexual example up in your booklet on redefining family, where they're talking about this. Well, right now, they said we're trying to say that homosexuals should have a right to marry too, but ultimately, we'd like marriage to be abolished as like a government as a government thing. Mm-hmm. And there is a singles rights movement in America as well, just pointing out that the fact that they don't think it's fair that the government gives tax breaks to people who have a marriage license. They say they're putting an unfair burden on singles because they don't get those tax breaks. They're saying that if you can abolish the practice of giving a marriage license, that way they would almost resolve the whole homosexual marriage versus civil unions thing, is that whether you're single, whether you've married a woman, whether you've married a man, whether you've married a sandwich, which someone actually did last week, you have no preference in the tax code at all.
Huh. Well, maybe another solution would be to just give the tax breaks to the people who marry themselves.
Right. I looked into that. You can't actually do that.
Okay. There's no actual legally binding advantages to the person who throws a $3,000 wedding for themselves. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. We've been talking about all of these stories that we talk about on the program here. We combine into a weekly report called The Trumpet Weekly. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Subscribe to this high-quality publication where we really try to pull together all of the important news from around the world over the previous week. You read this one report, 12 pages, really brings you up to speed on what is happening in your world and gives you some context and some analysis and some understanding about the events. We really try to sort the wheat from the chaff and give you what is most important. You can receive it every week, every Friday in your email inbox. We'd encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com and subscribe to The Trumpet Weekly. We're going to finish up the program next with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. We'll start with Andrew.
Americans are increasingly giving up on God. Well, one-fifth of the U.S. public no longer claims any religious affiliation. A new Pew Research study this week reveals that 50% of what they term the nuns have left church because they don't believe in God at all, compared to 20% who have left church just because they don't like organized religion.
All right, next we will go to Richard.
A couple of headlines from Germany showing that the country is moving towards more of a crisis footing. For the first time since the end of the Cold War, the German government plans to tell citizens to stockpile food and water in case of an attack or a catastrophe. That's what the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung reported on Sunday, and said that the nation was on high alert and looking at creating a special unit to counteract cyber crimes and terrorism. And then also the Spiegel online or published a story saying that the German cabinet is considering bringing back conscription in the case of an emergency that was suspended by former defense minister Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. And I think that helped speed the transition of the German army from a force designed to just throw as many men in the way of Soviet tanks as possible towards the more kind of skilled professional army that is adept at intervening overseas. But these two different discussions about the stockpiling food, about the conscription, it shows that leaders within Germany are seriously worried about the crisis and are seriously considering what they need to do about it and taking things up a level.
All right, now over to Brent.
Israeli jets carried out several rounds of fresh airstrikes in the Gaza Strip on Sunday night, just hours after a rocket landed in the border city of Sderot. Now, the relatively stiff response from Israel marks the most intense reprisal on Gaza since the sides fought a bloody war in 2014. It could also signal a shift in the policy of the newly installed defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman. A Hamas official told Israeli radio that the group was not interested in a renewal of violence. But earlier Sunday night, they held a large rally in the southern Gaza Strip where they paraded rockets through the street and threatened renewed fighting.
All right, now back to Andrew.
Racial tensions in the U.S. are escalating as a group called White Lives Matter rallied outside the NAACP headquarters in Houston this weekend. Several of the members were revealed to be previous members of the Aryan Resistance in Texas. No one was hurt at the rally, but it is another big sign of the escalating racial tension in the United States.
All right, we will go now to Richard.
The U.S. Treasury accused the EU of trying to establish a supranatural tax authority, and they said that a recent shift in approach by the EU in taxing in the way they do multinational taxation was aiming to turn the EU's competition authority into that worldwide tax authority. It also said what the EU is doing is inconsistent with EU legal principles and that the U.S. remains concerned about the possibility that Europe is targeting U.S. companies. So I think the EU's aggressive approach here plays into this growing trend of them trying to write the rules for all of global commerce. And Brad McDonald has an article on our website you can search for called Bending the World to Its Rules that goes through why this is something that's important to watch.
All right, over to Jeremiah.
Through a spy living in Florida, the Chinese government secretly tried to get its hands on a Reaper drone and several U.S. fighter jet engines for the purposes of reverse engineering them. There was a Chinese-born woman who was sentenced to 50 months in prison this week because she had tried to actually ship an engine from an F-35 jet and one from an F-22 and another one, I believe, to China so that the government there could reverse engineer those things. It's good that she was caught, but it shows how determined the Chinese military is to steal U.S. military technology.
Right, back over to Brent.
The Persian Gulf is heating up. This week, four separate incidents took place between the Iranian Navy or Iranian forces and the might of the American Fifth Fleet. The Americans were in international waters, but nevertheless, Iran's defense minister came out and said that any destroyer of any sort would be severely punished if they are found to encroach on our waters in the Persian Gulf. It might sound crazy that the Americans might actually leave the Persian Gulf, but given what Iran has demanded in the past and the fact that they've successfully blackmailed the United States of late, I wouldn't put it past them.
Back over to Richard.
A strong earthquake hit Italy at 3:30 a.m. on Wednesday. The death toll from that, I think, is close now to 270 at the latest count. It was a 6.2 magnitude earthquake. Located, the center of that was 50 miles northeast of Rome.
Back to Brent.
The State Department issued a warning on Monday urging U.S. citizens to avoid traveling to Iran, which has made the detention of Americans a priority. This latest advisory, which emphasizes Iran's desire to capture U.S. citizens, comes on the heels of the growing scandal over the Obama administration's decision to pay Iran $400 million in cash on the same day that it freed several U.S. hostages.
Okay, back to Jeremiah.
In the last few weeks, almost 2,000 people in the Philippines have been killed by police and by vigilante squads as part of the president's crackdown on drug crime. Those doing the killing say that all of the dead were guilty of trafficking or taking drugs, but these are extrajudicial killings taking place outside of any court proceedings and well outside the law of the Philippines Constitution. So it's hard to say how many of them were actually guilty of the crimes they were supposedly killed for.
And we will conclude with Andrew.
The heroin epidemic in the United States is intensifying, with 75 people dying from heroin overdoses this week in Indiana and Florida. Local authorities have an interesting conclusion as to why this week has been so deadly, as apparently many of the heroin shots being sold in Ohio are being laced with an elephant tranquilizer. Apparently, it only takes 2 milligrams of the substance to knock out a full-grown male elephant, which obviously is very deadly in humans.
Amazing. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories that we've talked about are in this week's edition. You can email us and tell us what you think of the program by sending in a note to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
To be with
you.
Great
to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Sam Uig. Hard work spotlights the character of people. Some turn up their sleeves, some turn up their noses, and some don't turn up at all. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.